Welcome back to Vulcan Hello, the Incomparables podcast dedicated to all things new Star Trek. I am Scott McNulty, and I am joined, as always, by Mr. Jason Snell. Hello, Jason.
Hello, Scott. It's good to be here. Happy Thanksgiving to you and to everybody out there who celebrates Thanksgiving, which is a perfectly logical holiday.
It is indeed celebrating the harvest and getting us to hunker down before the bleak winter, although in Philadelphia it's 65 degrees today. So
yeah, same here.
The climate, who knows what it's doing.
Yeah.
But we're going to be talking about Star Trek, Jason, not these American holidays that nobody cares about other than Americans. Although I did think to myself, because I am an American and we think the world revolves around us, that CBS might skip airing Discovery this week because it is Thanksgiving. But they did not.
Nope.
There's a new episode. So we're going to talk about it. Season 3, Episode 7, Unification 3, which is the third part in a TNG two-parter called Unification, which was intriguing. I remember our very first episode where we were scanning through the titles. We were intrigued by this title, and now we know what it's all about.
Yes.
So, Jason, I don't like to keep people in suspense about if we like the episodes or not. So I like to do it right in the front. So what did you think?
I liked it. I mean, I liked it better than last week. I think it was very... I was off my axis because I watched this in the morning, which is weird. I don't normally do that, but it was like a little Thanksgiving special. It's like watching the Doctor Who Christmas special or something. I like that they really are taking advantage of this setting to explore all these things that were set up in previous aspects of Star Trek, and this is in some ways the most referential episode of Discovery thus far, in that it is referencing like previous episodes of Discovery and sort of original series and directly the Next Generation, and and Picard gets referenced in here too. So there's a lot going on here, but I like the I know you like Romulans, and I don't really love Romulans, but I think having moved into the future so that you could explore what it means to have that unification of the Vulcans and the Romulans after the destruction of Romulus, sort of like, you know, Picard can't do that, but Discovery can, because Discovery can wind the clock ahead hundreds and hundreds of years. And so I thought that was a lot of fun. There are also, you know, lots of silly things that are very Star Trek silly. And so those are fun. And I laugh because it's like, well, of course, all Vulcan things are settled with some ancient ritual and or duel. Like,
yes,
they don't have scientific papers on Vulcan or Navarre, as they call it now. They have rap battles, except for science.
That's right, science battles is what they call
it.
I did think that this felt very much like a TOS episode, wherein some of my favorite TOS episodes are basically a bunch of people are in a room and they talk about stuff. This is a Star Trek Discovery episode where there are a bunch of people, they're in a room, and they talk about stuff.
Also, a very TOS thing, although TNG did this too, which is the, I invoke the ancient rite of the fill in the blank. And then a dignitary looks around and goes, well, there's no law against it, so I guess so. I guess we have to do that.
I guess. It is, in fact, in the rule book, so I must
like, all right.
I did imagine the Vulcan president, who seemed a bit exasperated by Michael Burnham's request for this ancient scientific tribunal, saying, fine, we'll do the ritual, but we're doing it on Discovery, and you provide the gong.
Yeah. That's right.
We are not negotiating on who provides gongs, because every Vulcan ritual, as we know, must have a gong.
It's got a gong.
Sort.
You provide the torches, the hollow torches. You provide the gong. We'll beam up. And that'll save your set budget from having to build a Vulcan location, and instead it'll just be on the Discovery. Yeah.
And I did wonder to myself, how many of those Vulcans and Romulans, and I forget what they call the Vulcan Romulan people,
Romicans? Yeah. Sure, Voles.
Ramekins.
Sure, Ramekins. The Voles and the Ramekins,
How many of them just beamed up because they
How many Voles fit in a ramekin? Not many. Ramekins are very small and Voles are large, Scott.
That is true. See, that's if you learn nothing from this podcast, learn that. They just, you know, hadn't been off their planet in a while, so they wanted to see what a Federation ship looked like. So they're like, fine, we'll be at this, this random science argument as long as we can sit in the mess hall and see what's going on.
Sure, exactly.
So this episode, last episode of our Vulcan Hello, I quipped that I thought, have we seen any Vulcans or Romulans? And then, of course, I saw the next on Discovery. And this is where they all are. They are all in this episode.
Here they are.
It's wall-to-wall Vulcan and Romulans and everything in between, which, of course, appeals to me as well.
Yeah. No, it's they're, they are aware that they're playing with Star Trek canon, but they're also trying to kind of evolve Star Trek canon. And that's one of the things I really enjoyed about that aspect of the episode. There's another plot with Tilly that we can talk about later, but the Vulcan and Romulan thing and Navarre, by the way, Navarre, for those, I actually recognized it when they said it because I had one of those, there were some of the first anthologies of original Star Trek fiction. Was Star Trek New Voyages volumes 1 and 2, and they were published in like the late 70s and early 80s, I want to say. And so there were like the James Blish novelizations and stuff, Alan Dean Foster and stuff like that. But then this New Voyages thing, it was like a short story anthology, and it turns out, I didn't realize this as a kid, but a lot of that was like fan fiction that ended up getting sort of bundled up and published for real in a real official authorized Star Trek book. And one of the stories in one of those books is called Navarre. And it's all, apparently this is from like a Spock related fanzine from the 70s. This term was coined, and it's about like duality and a dual nature, which is perfect for the Vulcans and the Romulans. So this is one of those cases. I actually had to stop and tell this to Lauren while we were watching it, because I said, what's cool about this is they could have made something up and it would be fine, right? Because people who don't have deep Star Trek background are not going to point at it and go, oh, I can't believe they used that name. But somebody went to the trouble of digging in ancient Star Trek, not even canon, fan canon, and pulled out Navarre to use it as the name of this unified Vulcan Romulan society. I thought that was awesome. Very few people will get that reference, but I love that it's been canonized, and that's a fun thing that they did as a part of this. And it leads to a great dramatic moment, right? Which is like, well, it's not actually called Vulcan anymore. And Burnham's like, what?
What? They changed the name of the planet?
Changed the name of the planet. Yeah, yeah. So that's a deep reference, and now it's canon, which is pretty awesome.
And within the episode, it of course, you know, drives home the fact that they are not where they, you know, everything here is unfamiliar, so unfamiliar that her second home planet is a different name now, and things are different, although still same ancient rituals, which are even more ancient now, are valid. So
even ancienter and ancienter. And she, I like that there's a funny moment in there where because she's like, I, as a graduate of the Vulcan Science Council, I demand this ritual. And the rejoinder that I thought was funny is, well, technically you are a citizen of Navarre. Like, it's like, I guess we have to issue you a passport. Again, there's no law against it, so it must be true.
Yeah. Right. Stop by the Navarre government building on your way out, and we'll update your papers.
It's because she was raised by Sarek and Amanda, you see, and that makes her a Vulcan citizen, because sadly her mother was like sucked up in a time vortex and lost forever and will never be seen again.
Now, I will say,
what now? I'm just. Oh,
well, that
she will be seen again. It turns out
she will
be
in this very episode, which was surprising. Wasn't expecting that, and it pleases me for two reasons. This episode pleases me on several levels because I enjoy Vulcans and Romulans. It felt like a good old fashioned Star Trek episode to me, but it also steered away from what I was worried about. And of course, this could be a false steering, and we could still end up someplace that I'm unhappy with. Because, you know, Jason, we talked about how we hope that Michael Burnham's mother didn't create the burn, and the Federation is hiding it, like maybe the Federation did it themselves. I feel like in this episode, they address both of those things, maybe not head on, but because there's this SB-119 or whatever it is, which is a Vulcan.
SB-19, yeah. Some
SB-19. Some Navarian, I suppose, research that was going on to, because the Federation was running out of dilithium and they were looking for alternate fuel sources, and they came up with these, basically it sounds like wormholes kind of dealies. And so they had sensors everywhere, and Michael Burnham needs that sensor data to
right. find the source hunch. Of the burn. Right.
And so now these people, the Navarians, think that they created the burn because of this failed experiment that the Federation forced them to continue. And so, you know, they think it's the Federation's fault for forcing them to destroy basically everything, which is interesting. And the Admiral, you think, oh, he doesn't want Burnham to see this research because it proves that the Federation was the burn. But he's like, no, it's they won't let us show it to you because they think we made them do the burn, which is interesting.
Of
course, we are worried about, oh no, Michael Burnham's mother is probably going to be a central point. And there's nothing against Michael Burnham's mother, but everything doesn't have to be exactly related to Michael Burnham.
Exactly.
And they take care of that very quickly in this episode, because she's one of those Romulan truth nuns.
Yeah, she's an absolute candor nun, which is not only fun, and she's got the sword and the thing and all that. I'm so relieved. When I saw her, I was like, oh, I mean, it's great. It's Kima from The Wire. I love the actress. She's great. But it's also like, oh, thank goodness she's not, you know, the answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything in this. It's just like they found some Romulans found her and nursed her back to health, and now she's in their order. Also, anybody who watched Picard, it's hilarious because Picard, that was just invented for season one of Picard, that whole bit of Romulan culture. And then here it is getting picked up here, which is Star Trek not about stuff like that? I think that's some of the great stuff about Star Trek. So, yeah, I was super relieved that she's not part of the grander universal scheme, but more like, and you could ask the questions of like, well, if she, you know, if she got, we don't know how long she's been there. Mm-hmm. And like, why hasn't she sought out Michael? But Michael's only been back for a year. Vulcan and the Federation, or Navarre and the Federation, have not been in contact. So she's probably been worried about Michael and wondering if she would ever see her again, although she doesn't know that Michael is trying to follow her or anything like that. But it's one of those things that like, I can step through that. The episode doesn't go through it. They're like, yeah, you know. No. They're happy. And at the end, there's that really great moment that I thought was really well done, where she says, basically, you know, I can say this for the first time, you always know where to find me. And I thought, that's really nice. Like, she's not going to be in the show every week, but like, Michael Burnham, for the first time, can like send messages to her mom. She can call mom, and she's never been able to do that before, because now they're both living in this era, and that's cool. I like that.
That is cool, and I like that a lot. And there was, and so this episode really is all about, you know, the unfamiliarity, Michael Burnham's quest to, as her mother, I think, put it, something like, be involved in important things or make everything about her. Or Spock said that, and there's a lot of Spock. Well, not a lot, but there's a little bit of Spock. Enough Spock in this episode. I got a little teary eyed when they played Unification with Leonard Nimoy as Spock and doing his one of his monologues from that episode.
It's so great. So talking about Spock for a second, like, there's a moment at the beginning, which is brilliant, where you know, everybody suddenly has to come to the realization, which is like, no, Burnham, your brother is famous.
He is very important.
You being his sister, we can say, hey, we have Spock's sister. She's going to come visit you, and they have to let us in. And she's like, I don't know. And they're like, no, you got to do this. Like,
that's not a suggestion. That's an order.
Yeah, you got to do this. And I like that they have the flashback with Ethan Peck. And I thought, well, this is how we know Spock in this show, so that's okay. And then later I realized, oh, so they did that so they could contrast that with Leonard Nimoy in that Next Generation episode with his monologue about bringing the Romulans back together. I was actually a little sad that we didn't get one line. Probably they tried to write it and maybe it got cut. That was, you know, he died trying to save Romulans from the thing from the supernova that destroyed their planet, because by this they don't know about the alternate reality created in J.J. Abrams' Star Trek movie, right? The last record of Spock would be that he died on this mission to save Romulans. So very clearly, you know, the whole history of Spock is of unifying Romulans and Vulcans and even sacrificing his life to try to save Romulans. So I like that we get to see Spock. We get the emotional hit. Burnham gets to have a moment of taking the emotional hit of letting herself do something she didn't let herself to do, which is find out what happened to her brother. What was his life like? Which leads to what Book saying, like, wow, that is a family that aspires high, right? Like,
that's good stuff. Overachievers.
That's good stuff. And then obviously for the modern day people on Navarre, like, Spock is a reference point, but they all have their own petty things that they're going back and forth about. And I you know, that was also good too, because it's not like, oh, the revered Spock, we must do what Spock's sister says, right? No, it's like they've got their own issues going on. But I love that I didn't expect this kind of a payoff from her relationship with Spock, for them to cash it in this way, now that they're in the future. And I thought that was pretty cool.
I agree.
Plus, we know that guy. It's like, hey, Spock, we know Spock.
We know Spock. We're very familiar with Spock. We like Spock. Everyone should like Spock.
We do.
So the Vulcans, I'm sure, like Spock, but also I'm sure the Vulcan president is like, gee, thanks, Spock. I have to deal with all of this stuff because of you.
Yeah. That's right. Exactly.
They're
right.
Dealing with a lot on Navarre. It is very clear.
It's a handful. It's they got different. And unlike, I mean, this is also, Star Trek so often has like, everything's a world government. Mm-hmm. And here with Navarre, they have a world government clearly, but also very clearly, because especially of the influence of the Romulans repatriating to the planet, they have a lot of internal political struggle that we don't often see on Star Trek where, you know, there are planet, you know, elements within a planet. We don't tend to go down that far into politics, but here we are.
Yes, there. It is clear there's a Romulan side. There's at least one Vulcan side, although I sense there are two Vulcan sides, at least, because the president doesn't seem all as aligned with the Vulcan in the tribunal.
The mix the people who are sort of like mixing the cultures up, and they're part Romulan and part Vulcan and all that. That was one of the things I liked least in the episode, is that we have so many characters that get introduced at once, and Burnham's mother basically says, all right, and she goes into detail about what all their political positions are, and I thought, yeah, this is a lot to just say, well, there's a mean guy and there's a nice guy, and then there's this lady who can't decide. So good luck,
because
like, clearly they don't have, and I, on one level, it's okay, because it's like everybody on Discovery is like, please, I know how to handle myself. And it's like, you've been gone for 900 years. You have no idea. And that's what her mother says. You have no idea what's going on. And like, if you parachute into some country's politics after hundreds of years have gone by, you have no idea what all the triggers are and what everybody is trying to get at. So like, the mean guy and the other person, like, and Burnham's like, well, I'll just speak the truth and it'll be fine. It's like,
I'll appeal to their logic, because if he is... Yeah. Truly a Vulcan purist, then he will uphold nothing higher than logic.
She has not seen Star Trek. Does she not know how awful Vulcans are and how jerks they are?
And that's what her mother says. Oh, sure, they all use logic to get what they want.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yes, that is how you describe Vulcans. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
She knows what's up. And she's absolute candor, so she's not telling any lies there. I did think that, I mean, I am not a Vulcan or a Romulan or somewhere in between, but if I were on that tribunal, I might object to having her, Michael Burnham's mother, being her advocate. Just seems like maybe there's some conflict of interest or something there. But maybe not. Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah, my other, talking about that part of this episode, the science duel, I don't know. I mean, it is silly in a Star Trek way. It is a Vulcan duel of battle of wits or whatever, and it's done in this way. But in the end, she's sort of just appealing to the elders of Vulcan to share her knowledge and for them to share their knowledge, and that's all fine. My big thing, and I wonder if this is going somewhere or not, but my big issue is that she comes into it saying, fully bought into the premise, which is like, Federation is great, and I'm here representing them, but I'm also representing myself, and I'm trying to do this, and it's all fine, and you should listen to me because the Federation is good. And Saru says the same thing, which is, you know, the Federation is good, and I believe in it. And even the president of Navarre is like, yeah, Maybe. And I kept saying to myself throughout the episode, do we really trust the Federation? I mean, it's been a long time, and they look like the Federation, and that guy is only a little bit squirrely, who's the admiral in charge of it. But I wonder, like, I find myself wondering, and maybe that's a plot of the show, or maybe it's just me trying to apply logic to something that's just a show, and I can't decide which, but, like, when Burnham is putting it all down for the Federation and saying, like, I'm here for the Federation, we're good, you need to listen to us, I have this nagging thought in the back of my head, which is, like, why, you're really lending a lot of credence to your trust of the Federation, an organization that you've been around for a few weeks now. And right. And not for 900 years before that. You don't know, you know, and I can't decide if the show wants me to take it as read that, yes, the Federation is good and it's fine, or not.
Well, I think that they're doing a slow reveal on the Federation of what they did very quickly in this episode, which is that, you know, you've been gone for a long time. You do not know what's going on in Navarre. It's more complicated than you think. It doesn't mean it's bad. Doesn't mean it's good. It's just very complicated.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what we're going to find out, because, you know, the Discovery is just happy that they found the Federation and that they can help rebuild it. But I think we're even, you know, they've been doing this subtly through a couple of episodes that you know, that Admiral's a little squirrely and he's not telling you everything.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I don't think that it's going to turn out that the Federation is some kind of now evil syndicate or something. But I think it's going to be a little more complicated than anyone thinks, because the right. Federation had to do some things that the Federation wouldn't do normally, as was referenced in this episode, where they basically said, you know, why did Navarre leave the Federation? And it's because they forced us to continue doing this experiment, which we didn't want to do. But B, they were, you know, they let the needs of the few outweigh the needs of the many, or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Or they let they said the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And Saru was like,
that's your thing.
Coin that phrase. And she's like, well, yeah, but we have moved beyond aphorisms because reality is difficult.
Yeah, right. We could read that as being, they are wise now. Or like, oh no, they've compromised their morals. And it's unclear whether they or the Federation or both. Like, yes, I think that's what I hope, Scott. I hope that this is leading to a complex situation where there's no easy answer, there's no good or bad, and that everybody has to adapt and put the work in if they want to reestablish the Federation to be something meaningful. Instead of it being like, oh, but the secret is that the Federation got taken over by the Mirror Universe and they're using the Emerald Chain to... I don't want it to be a big conspiracy. I really would rather it be about grappling with complexity and ideals, but... we'll see.
Or could be that the finally that payback for that TNG episode where the admirals were all infected with those little worms.
Yes. And, the worm people have taken over. And
that's right.
And I think it is fascinating, too, that there are these factions within Navarre that are like, we blame ourselves for the burn. And other people are like, wait, but if we didn't do the burn, isn't that good? Like, shouldn't we want to find that out? And I like that... I mean, talk about your parallels with modern politics. This episode does have them there, where it's like there's a scientific fact, but the people are more concerned about how the scientific fact can be used or ignored in order to further their political ends. Mm-hmm. That's going on here. And also, I thought just the fact that they say that dilithium was being scarce because of overuse, because of the size and expansion of the Federation, and the idea that the growth of the Federation actually led to the ecological disaster as they began to use more resources than the universe was able to provide for them to consume. Also, again, there is an ecological parallel there with us, and I think that's interesting because that's laying it at the foot of the Federation's ideals, saying the Federation growing and providing goodness around the galaxy actually led to its demise, which is, you know, that's I like that too, because that's challenging some of our assumptions about Star Trek.
And unintended consequences are always a rich vein for stories, right? Of
yeah.
You're trying to do good, and then you inadvertently do very bad things that you did not mean, and that leads to complicated stories. And hopefully, that's where we're going. Because anytime an organization is completely good or completely bad, it's just not that interesting, right? Unless it's in this kind of comic booky, I guess, kind of world. But I think that these writers are, you know, if we've learned anything from Discovery, they are trying to make a more complicated universe, morally complicated universe in Star Trek than we have seen before.
Right. Right. You could even argue that the whole point of Discovery has been people who believe in the fundamental morals of the Federation struggling with the complexity of organizations and events in order to find a way to uphold the ideals of Star Trek, essentially. And it's messy and it's complicated. And we're seeing that again here, like we did sort of in the first season, where they really got challenged and had to stand up for what they believed in. Here they are, you know, arguably the ones trying to relight the torch of the Federation by bringing in those values from 900 years before. And it's complicated. You can't just say, we're good, join up, because it doesn't work that way. And Disco has always been about that to a certain degree, I think.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I like the resolution of the science rap battle is basically Burnham's mother is like, you know, you're not telling the truth. And so I have to tell everybody. I have to
bad things about you.
Blow up your spot, as the kids say. I don't think they actually say that anymore.
No.
But at some point, kids said that. And so she basically says, you know, isn't it true that you were, you know, a mutineer and didn't you just do that again?
Yep.
So why should we trust you? Very, very fair question, Mom, but not in front of the Vulcans. and you know, that's a great point. And that's when, you know, basically she makes Burnham tell the truth and say, you know, I don't feel like I fit in here, but I've always strived to do for the greater good. And so that's why you should trust me. And the Vulcans are like, no thanks.
Well,
hard pass.
And it leads to this moment where, you know, now she's telling the truth, and that part is now undeniable. And it's like with her mom's help, they're trying to boil away and get this thing to where what it's supposed to be, which is, let's just put the truth out here, which is, I have information, you have information, if we put it together, we can answer this question. And when put in that way, what the Vulcans and Romulans say is some degree of, if we do this, it will destabilize everything on the planet politically. And the reason we're fighting to not exchange information with you, or the one guy is fighting to exchange information, is not really about the pursuit of truth. It is about everything that we're doing, you know, with each other.
Right.
And
it's a delicate balance.
Yeah. And that's the moment where Burnham does exactly the right thing, which is to say, I withdraw my request. And they're like, what? And it's a nice moment, but also it is kind of completely logical, which is, now that we've reached this point, it's clear that this request has ramifications far beyond what I thought. Or as one Vulcan said in an incredibly weird bit of modern terminology, it's a big ask.
I did laugh out loud when she said, because it's like they're in these trappings, and it's, I mean, I know they're on a starship, but it's their flames and a gong and their Vulcans, and I'm like, what? And
your presentation was very impactful, but it's a big ask. It's a big ask.
Can we take this offline and ping me later?
Oh, boy. So that made me laugh. What I wrote down is, that is a big ask, said a Vulcan. but anyway, like that's that great moment where it's like, I withdraw. I didn't realize what I was stepping in here. And although I am searching for truth, and some of you may be searching for truth, the truth is going to wreck your society to a certain degree. So I'm just going to back away. And I'm thinking in the back of my head, also, the president is going to give you the data,
because
she's sort of above all this, and she can slip it to you on the sly while everybody saves face here, which, like you said, there is a fourth side here. It's not just the three factions. It is also the president, who's got like bigger fish to fry. And I like that character a lot, and I like her talking with Saru and talking about big picture. And it's like, it's going to take us some visits. This is complex, but I'd love to chat with you more. That all of that kind of stuff is going on. So I like that moment though, when Burnham says, now that we've finally burned this crucible down and there's nothing left but the truth, I'm not going to ask you for the truth. I'm going to walk away. It's a really good moment.
It is a good moment. And a very Starfleet-y kind of thing to do.
Right.
Because you're like, I show up, I know nothing of a situation, but I assume I know how to fix it.
Uh-huh. I step in it.
Oops. Turns out I was wrong. Sorry.
Captain Kirk would say, just give me the stuff and your civilization is stupid. Goodbye. And Burnham is like, never mind. I'm walking
never
away.
Mind. Yeah. My mistake. See you later. And hopefully, yeah. I think she says something about, you know, I trust, you've earned my trust. And then she kind of leaves, which I thought was nice as well.
Yeah.
Like, I've been asking and begging you to trust me without really thinking about why you should trust, why I, you know, on your side, like, why should you, I want you to trust me, but why should you? And she says, well, at least you've earned my trust because you've been forthright and now I'm leaving. And as you said, the Vulcan president's in the audience, and she's impressed, and so she gives Burnham the data that she wants. Hooray. And that's the other thing I really liked. Like, this is all a bunch of meetings so that Burnham can get some data.
In the mess hall, I mean, in Next Generation, it would be around, like, the ready room table, right? It would be, or the conference room table. So
and that just, it just pleases me so much that they, because, you know, you would expect in a modern day show there'd be a little more things exploding and high stakes drama, and there's a little sex at the beginning, but
when people talk about Star Trek, it's like, you know, when they complain about Star Trek movies having action in them, they're like, mm-hmm. It should be about ideas and talking, and like TV Star Trek isn't just about ideas and talking. There's a lot of people punching and, you know, firing laser beams and phasers.
Because it's fun to see that.
Yeah, and photon torpedoes and all that. But this episode is one of those where it's like, yeah, it is about the ideas and the characters and the talking. And mm-hmm. this is very, very Star Trek in that way. I like the line, dispense by mom, wisdom, dispense by mom at the end is, you know, your duty leads to happiness and the joy gives you something real that you can fight for. And she's like trying to like boil it down to Michael about why, you know, why she feels this conflict and perhaps that there isn't a conflict, which leads to, you know, Michael at the end saying, you know, she's here for the duration. She's not going anywhere. Whereas Book was like, come join me, travel the universe.
Yes. And she's like, fun. I have a cat.
Yeah. You know, what more do you need? So yeah, that's not the kind of episode that somebody who doesn't understand Star Trek would, I think, make any sense out of, but
no.
I enjoyed it because it was unabashedly deeply Star Trek lore mm-hmm. and our characters and growing and changing and learning, but navigating, you know, with a Vulcan gong, you know.
And how? What better way to navigate? Now that's all a plot. That's the bulk of the episode.
Yeah.
But by the way, a good Star Trek episode.
Jean-Luc Picard named.
Yes, name drop.
Which is fun, and none of them know mm-hmm. who he is because he's from after their time. But it was one of these like, we retrieved this from the files of Jean-Luc Picard, and it's, you know, it's, and now he apparently had bought the VHS of Unification 1 and 2 because
I guess, and he had it up-res to a hologram, so that was nice.
Good. Well, you know, you got to do that. Otherwise, people don't want to watch VHS anymore. They want holograms.
No, I guess that's it. They want holograms. So 2D.
So we only get a reference to the quote Malat, the warrior nuns. From Star Trek Picard, but we also get Picard named in that episode.
Admiral Picard,
which
is named.
Delightful.
Yes. Delightful.
And then there's the B-plot, which involves Tilly.
Tilly.
Before we get to Tilly, though, I want to wind back to that first scene where they're talking to the Admiral, just because I have a question for you, which is, how do floors work?
It's all smart matter, Jason.
It's all
they appear where you need them.
Yeah. So they build a big tube and then you just kind of walk out into open space and it like builds you a bridge, and then when you stop, it's like, oh, I guess you want this to be a floor. I don't know. Well, it's neat looking, but I don't understand the logic of like making different spaces into floors or bridges or whatever. It's very strange.
Well, they used that shot in that episode where they first found the Federation.
Yeah.
It was obviously used. So like, woo, they've got new technology, even the floors are different here. But I was surprised to see it used again because it is kind of a ridiculous
thing. What if
it looks
you want
cool,
to put a chair down? I guess the chair come out of the floor, right?
Exactly. You're not thinking the right way, Jason.
Yeah, I need to get up on my programmable matter.
The world is your floor in the future.
Okay.
Wherever you go,
there's a floor. It's great. Good to know. All right, Tilly gets a promotion.
Tilly gets a promotion as an acting first officer. So as we know, last episode,
She's got to be. She's got to get promoted to lieutenant, though, right? She's got to get promoted to lieutenant.
So.
Yeah.
So Michael Burnham, no longer first officer of the Discovery. You know, which I think makes a lot of sense, both story wise and internally consistency, right? Because she doesn't follow orders, and that's a problem. And it's not the first time, as we found out, right? So she's not. She's just science officer or chief science officer. So it's not.
Yeah,
that big of a problem, right? But now Saru needs a number one, and so he says, "Hey Tilly, do you want to be acting number one while I find a permanent replacement?" Which I assume is going to be Tilly because she's going to do such a good job
and
be the permanent number one. But that's just my supposition. And so that's the whole plot. The B plot is Tilly is like, "Are you sure? I'm only an ensign. Are you just doing this because I'll be compliant?" Which I thought was good. And he's like, "I'll think about it for a day," which means wander around the ship and talk to people.
Yeah.
and that's what she does. She goes, she talks to Stamets, who is not as supportive as one might hope. Although I, you know, if you're expecting him to be supportive, I think you're going to the wrong place. Although it resolves very nicely. And she says, basically, "I'm going to be, Saru asked me to be his acting number one. Should I take it?" And he says, his first reaction is, "Does that mean you'll be my superior officer?"
And then he's like, "That would be really weird." And then she gets called away.
Yes.
So he doesn't get to. No, I didn't. I didn't mean it.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was a bad time.
Their conversation ended abruptly, and so she basically thinks, "Oh, great, he doesn't think I should take it," which I don't think is what he was getting at.
No.
But it does appear that way. And then basically, it all culminates with her saying, "You know, I don't know if I want to do it." And at the end of the episode, she walks into engineering because Stamets wants to talk to her. And everybody's there, with the exception of Saru and Burnham, and they all basically say yes, and they, you know, because, you know, it's a big thing. She's an ensign. They all report to her. It'd be weird, but they are like, "Tilly, we know you. We would follow you anywhere. You should do it."
Yeah, I like. That's a really great scene, right? Because it's we know you, and we know you would be good at this. Because yes, on its face, it's like, "Oh, well, it's Tilly, and she was just an ensign, and she was in the command training program." And as Saru says, like, "I think you pretty much passed the training program. I know we didn't finish it, but instead we went into the future, and you've proven yourself." And we all know, we've watched the show, we all know how great Tilly is. So this is that moment where the crew, who also watches the show apparently, says, "You're great. Say yes, we support you. You would be great at this." Because the fact is, Tilly, although a fun character, also is relentlessly competent and totally aware of like people's feelings and stuff. Like she's I think a people person as well as an incredibly competent officer. And we've been watching from the very beginning her ambition for command. And Saru sees this opportunity for her to step up and give it a try. But the moment where all of her colleagues are like, "Yeah, you could do this," is great. And then I love I love the extra bit, which is Burnham comes in and she's feeling really guilty because this is basically Burnham's old job and she feels really bad about it. And Burnham says, "Did I miss the cool say yes part?" That was great.
Yes.
Because it's like they all planned it, and she's like, "I missed it." It was good. That made me laugh.
Yes. And Burnham is on board with it. She's like, "Tilly, you go for it. I am here for the duration," which was nice, right?
Yeah.
Because throughout this whole season, basically, Burnham is like, "Should I stay? Should I go? I don't really feel like I fit in here anymore because of my year away and all that." So
she's been reminded why this part of it's not just like the Federation or whatever, but it's like why this is important to her, this experience and her mom's wisdom, right? Wise Vulcan Romulan warrior nun lady wisdom. It has which is true because it's absolute candor, like has reminded her of why she's here, even though I would not put it past her to continue ignoring orders. Secret to managing Michael Burnham is to give her orders that she'll follow.
Oh, that's right. That's how you manage up with Michael.
My tip. My tip for Tilly is only give Burnham orders you know she'll actually do. And then she follows orders. Simple.
She does. It's great. Yeah. And that, I mean, that's the interesting thing about the number one position in Star Trek and possibly on ships in the military. I have no idea if what the first officers do, is that they are in charge of the crew, basically. The captain is in charge of making all the decisions about everything, but they need someone to manage the people. And that's what the first officer does. And so I think that Tilly is a very good choice for that. And so I'll be interested to see how she handles it.
We'll see how she progresses.
And what hijinks ensue.
Yes. Oh, yes. Hijinks. It wouldn't be a show if there weren't hijinks.
That's true. It would be a very short show if no hijinks ensued. Well, Jason, it is, for Americans at least, I guess for everybody, but Americans are the only ones that care at this moment, Thanksgiving. So I hope you have a happy turkey-full Thanksgiving, if you're having turkey.
Yes, I'm not, but some people will be, and that's just fine. I want to read, before we go, the article about Thanksgiving from Memory Alpha, which points out that Charles Tucker III's childhood involved a Thanksgiving turkey on their dining room table. That's in the Enterprise episode Observer Effect. There is a meatloaf served for Thanksgiving on the Enterprise instead of turkey in Charlie X, but then Charlie X uses his super mind powers to turn the meatloaf into turkey.
Oh, I remember that.
And then Ben Sisko invites Deep Space Nine staff to Thanksgiving dinner, and that's in Deep Space Nine, Blaze of Glory.
I think a Klingon says something about, yes, I will eat some of your replicated cooked bird. Worf probably says that. That sounds like something Worf would say.
Yeah. And there's turkey and a bunch of other things, but there's your Thanksgiving Star Trek. That's what I got for you. So happy Thanksgiving. And live long and prosper, which apparently they still say in the 31st century. What a relief.
They're ancient rituals, Jason.
I thought has gone beyond those silly maxims, but apparently not that one.
That one's really good and catchy.
Yeah, it's true. And the hand thing.
Yeah, the hand thing. I'm doing it right now.
So am I.